Welcome to Radio Survivor. We're here for the love of radio and sound. I'm Jennifer Waits.
Hi, I'm Eric Klein.
And on today's show, we're talking about women and sound. Our guests are scholars Jennifer Hyland Wong, who is an adjunct professor at University of Wisconsin-Madison, and Jenny Stover, who is an associate professor of English at Binghamton University and the co-founder and editor-in-chief of the Sounding Out Sound Studies blog and podcast. Welcome to both of you, and thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you. Great
to be
here.
It's a pleasure.
So a few years back, we had some incredible conversations with both of you on the show about sound studies, the cultural politics of listening, and the history of women's voices on the airwaves and on podcasts. As we celebrate Women's History Month, it's a great opportunity to revisit these themes with an eye towards representation as well. So I thought maybe that we could first situate ourselves a bit historically in sound. Women have played an important role in radio and podcasting from the very beginning, yet their contributions aren't always a part of the official stories of audio history. And we often think of radio and podcasting as male-dominated spaces. So, Jennifer Hyland Wong, could you give us a snapshot of this history and women's contributions to those early days of radio and podcasting?
The little that we know, what we do know, is that women had a big contribution that before mediums like radio or even podcasting got networked or professionalized or routinized, standardized, women actually were part of a very gendered, sound mix. I'm thinking particularly in the early ages of radio, in the early 1920s, women were participating in a wide range as radio announcers, as station managers, in various kinds of roles in radio. And it was really the process of those becoming more commercialized and more routine that sort of pushed women's voices sort of out of various areas of radio.
And that's something we've talked about in the show. We've even had episodes about people like Amy Semple McPherson, who was this amazing evangelist and radio station owner. And we often don't, those of us today often don't hear that story about this very powerful woman. And I've seen it across other industries, too. I recently watched a documentary about Elise Guy Blaché, who was, ostensibly one of the first filmmakers, ever, not to mention the first female director, and her contributions to film, even though they were written about at the time, they were erased by people who are writing that history down the road. So I'd love to hear a bit, Jenny Stover, if you have thoughts about that dynamic and, women's voices sort of being erased even in that official history as time went on, even though they might have been recognized as station owners and contributors at the beginning. And so there's that dynamic of being erased that I'm curious about, but also, now I'm adding on two questions, but also how women's voices have been interpreted over the airwaves over the years. So I'm complicating it.
that's a fantastic question because for many reasons, I found in my own research on race and sound and its intersections with gender that the period of nationalizing of radio was also a period when Black people and people of color were pushed off the national airwaves as well. And there was actually, dramatically less presence on the airwaves for Black people in particular in the 40s than there was in the 20s. And, this includes, important roles like show announcers. There are almost no Black show announcers. There were very limited spots for musicians. I studied Lena Horne quite a bit and a lot of the circumscribing of her voice and the way that she would often be placed alone on a show in a segment where she wasn't interacting with other people on the show or she was only interacting with the host. And so there's a way that especially unscripted Black voices and Black women's voices were marginalized on the radio. And also, they weren't considered as audience members either. And I've seen a lot of archival discussion of advertising and why no one was even reaching or considering Black people and Black women in particular as listeners. So it was in all areas, writers unions in terms of voiceover work, even in terms of musicians, that there were segregated musicians unions in Los Angeles where most of the radio work was orchestral. And it was directed toward the white union because it was thought by radio station owners that that's who played orchestral music. And anything that went to the Black union was jazz or blues. So there was a sonic color line set up in terms of music too. So it definitely was a period where all of those marginalized voices were further marginalized by the sound of radio on air for nationalized stations.
Yeah, that's... So are you both arguing that in the very, very early days of radio, there may have been more diversity and more freedom than there was as radio progressed?
Absolutely. I mean, if I can jump in, I was thinking about a quote from 1933. There were a couple of radio researchers named Gordon Allport and Hadley Cantrell, and they analyzed what kind of voices, particularly what kind of women's voices, would succeed on the air. And they were saying that America's audiences were partial to men's voices, but more specifically, they found women with vulgar or uncouth sounding voices far more pleasing than a cultured woman's voice. And so they explain that, quote, "most of us like our women radio artists beautiful, as the singer Jessica Dragonette presumably is, or funny, as the comedians Clara Lou and M certainly are." And so even as early as 1933, here's this parameter being put around, you know, you could be pretty, which was very hard on radio, right? You know, with the visual element out, or funny. But that's it.
And why, I don't know, I don't even know what a cultured voice is, but why was a cultured voice displeasing?
There was a fear of, they argued it was that they felt the audience had an anti-marm school complex, that they didn't like to be preached to. And so that a woman with a cultured voice who knew what she was talking about, I think about in this period previous to this, in between 1928 and 1932, there was a series of daytime homemaking shows were the first kinds of radio programs for women. And so you would have a lot of home economic professors, home economic experts who would be telling you how to scientifically manage your home, how to raise your family. And they interpreted the relative lack of success of those kinds of programs to people's opinions about not wanting to be preached to by women. It feels like there's almost like a little bit of like Elizabeth Warren vibe, you know, like, like the kind of critique that was made about her voice during the campaign, you know, that she was explaining things to people. There was a lot of undue sensitivity to the tone of her voice and how she explained things, and that was certainly it was found even in the early 1930s.
And Jennifer Highland Wong, were there women's voices before that who were on the radio as the experts that then, you know, did women take up that space prior to this moment? And what can you describe that space again? What's this third space where somebody gets to have authority that now I associate with a male voice? What do we even call that? Someone who knows what they're talking about, a grown-up.
Yeah. Well, I think Frances Dyson is a kind of a radio theorist, and I think she had said something like the authoritative voice of radio is the voice of a man. It's the voice of the singular, the voice of the authoritative. In particular, I was doing some research on an early radio program called Clara Lou and M. And one of the interesting things I found in my analysis is the way that they designed the soundscape to make it sound like the voices of the many. that to make it sound like all of these women were sort of talking on top of each other. And that was one of the major critiques of the show and why that perhaps it wasn't appropriate for primetime air. It's because they had all of these, because you had the voice of women in primetime, and then they were moved to daytime in 1932 as a way to add a sort of gender divide to the broadcast schedule.
You're talking about a show called Clara, Lou, and M, and I want you to tell us a little more about it. And please forgive me. Is it okay for me to compare it to a television show, The View, in which a group of women sit around a table, you know, talking about the issues of the day on TV?
Yeah, I mean, the what was really fascinating about this program was that it was designed to be three women who would go to the back fence. They lived in the same sort of kind of house. They would kind of go outside and meet each other each day and gossip for 15 minutes.
This is a radio show.
This is a radio show. So you were eavesdropping on these gossiping women. In actuality, the three women who played and originated the roles were Northwestern University graduates and of their School of Speech and Dramatics. And they were pretending to be sort of lower class, sort of Midwestern housewives for this conceit. And what they essentially did was really kind of extraordinary because they were appearing first over WGN. They would read the newspaper and come up with that day's script. So they wrote and produced and voiced everything in the program. And then they intended the show to be these group of women talking about politics and what was in the news, which was such a rarity at that time, and that they would kind of get their messages out kind of that way. So they had to pretend in some ways, the originators had to pretend to be what they were not over the air.
Clara, Lou, and M, and this was on the air in the 1930s, did you say?
Yeah, it started in 1930. It's WGN, and then within a few weeks was picked up and was on NBC until 1936, 37.
Yeah, didn't you share with us the last time that you were on that they that they were big enough celebrities that they had a role to play in
the inauguration? Yep. They were the only in NBC and CBS's coverage of the FDR's first inauguration in 1933. They were just newsmen who, you know, eminent newsmen who were kind of speaking about all the different kind of goings on. And then they were the only voice of women in their program. And the voice that they had was of these kind of cartoonish housewives. So they actually couldn't speak in their own voices, but had to adopt these cartoonish kind of coos and twitters and things to even be on the air. So that was like the way that the institution wanted them sort of represented.
That makes me think, Jennifer Hyland Wong makes me think about Jennifer Stover's work with the Sonic Color Line and how people often have to take on different voices. Maybe you could talk a little bit about that, Jenny Stover, during this period of time, perhaps on the radio. What was that like for women of color?
Yes, it was an extremely difficult period where you had very famous actresses who would go on and do radio, and they would be asked to read accented dialect script that was written by white readers and white writers to sound Black to white listeners. So they would have to put on a stylized, racist, kind of stereotypical accent in order to be able to perform and to be able to be on radio shows. Barbara Savage, the radio historian, has called this essentially aural blackface. At the time, in the 40s, Elaine Locke, a famous professor from Howard, called it the cornfield voice. And it was a way of presenting the color line on radio. And so you had women that were at the intersection of the kinds of performance of womanhood that Jennifer Hyland Wong just spoke of, and then a certain kind of racial performance. Hattie McDaniel was on the radio, and she's someone that on Beulah was having to struggle to work within that. There were women such as Butterfly McQueen, who actually refused to speak in dialect, and she was essentially pushed out of a radio career. And you had, you know, resistant reactions and resistant moves anywhere in between there. And so Black women came up with a variety of strategies on air, but it was very difficult for them. And oftentimes, if there was a fear that they could not be distinguished by white listeners as Black, they would be let go from programs. And this was presented as realism on the radio, I think is you know, has been very damaging for women and for Black women in particular.
Wow. Jenny Stover, you just described a culture of Black women's voices particularly being either distorted by the white people who had the power over how they reached the airwaves, or their careers were defined by white people. Was this in the 1940s, I'm assuming?
Yes, this was in the 1940s.
Yeah, so it's... yeah, I just wanted to, like, say it twice into the microphone that there was a moment where a different radio was possible in the United States, and then those microphones were taken away, essentially.
Well, and I like Jenny Stover that you're pointing out that there were women who tried to subvert that, and I'd love to hear more about because I'm hoping today we can celebrate a lot of the women who kind of refuse to fall into the stereotypes and are really powerful people. I hope that we can point our listeners to, you know, radio shows and podcasts featuring women who have really, you know, voiced their truth. So any examples you can share about that would be great to hear. And maybe we start with those early years and then we flash forward into podcasting, you know, momentarily.
Yes. Well, one of the voices that I want to mention is someone that I am working on researching, and I was supposed to present on her this year at the Radio Preservation Task Force conference, which was unfortunately put off to COVID because of COVID. But I'd like to mention that, you know, in terms of the archive, one of the most amazing voices that I found was that of Estelle Edmerson, who collected oral histories of Black radio performers, writers in the 1950s. And it was for her MA thesis at UCLA called A Descriptive Study of the American Negro in United States Professional Radio, 1922 to 1953. It is phenomenal. It is a PhD project, not a master's thesis. It's phenomenal where, you know, she went and talked to Mady Norman and Lillian Randolph and Wonderful Smith, Flournoy Miller. She also talked with white executives from CBS and NBC who told her astonishing, overtly racist things, probably not assuming, knowing, you know, thinking that anything would come of it. And I am grateful to it. You know, it's the foundation for my own research. And so I want to, you know, talk more about who she was, Estelle Louise Edmerson Banks. She grew up in Austin, Texas, and she was a drum majorette, a touring musician, a radio writer, performer, singer, dancer, playwright, and musician in Los Angeles. And she helped desegregate the Musicians Union in the mid-50s in Los Angeles. So I am really excited in, you know, sharing more about her and doing more research on her, and getting more people aware of, you know, the work that she's done and the importance of this thesis to my understanding of radio and the Sonic Color Line in radio.
That's really exciting, Jenny Stover. So you're describing Estelle Edmerson's project.
Yes.
So let's talk a little bit more about what you learned from that project, because I'm hearing, you know, here on Radio Survivor, we've already mentioned how many microphones were literally and metaphorically taken away from women of color, how many times their voices were distorted by white people who had the money to distort their voices, you know, literally like making them read the dialect that was not the voice that they would choose to use on the radio, stuff like that. But now, then yes. you just told us that there were black people on the radio. What were these radio stations that Estella Edmerson studied for those decades that you mentioned?
Well, those are the things that I'm actually reconstructing right now and trying to find out. You know, a lot of the traces I have of her are from, you know, brief mentions in newspapers. And so those are one of the things as a scholar that I've been working on uncovering. I'm trying to even remember how I found her dissertation. I had to order an archival copy, a physical copy. It's been a few years. I when I was studying at Cornell, I came across it in a database and ordered it from UCLA and had the pleasure of reading it. And, you know, she gets very, very candid, you know, information from people that she's talking to, like the case of Wonderful Smith, who was on the Red Skelton Show. And he formally had been fired, according to the network, because of going to fight for the war. But he told her for her research that, you know, as I was talking about, that he felt that he was let go because his voice, it was a sketch comedy show. And because he had to slip in and out of so many characters, they got mail about Southern listeners in particular, white Southern listeners being confused as to his ethnicity. And he's like, no one will ever say it, but that's why I got fired from the show. And there's a lot of those pieces in there. And she also tells the story of Butterfly McQueen, who we know, you know, so many people only know her work from Gone with the Wind and the caricature that she performed in Gone with the Wind, and the particular tone of her voice, very high pitched, you know, very, you know, presented as incompetent in that film. And, you know, she opens up a whole nother side to her, where she quit the Amos and Andy show because she did not want to be a maid on that show. That was not why she went on there. And so, you know, a lot of those powerful moments, I was able to, you know, cull and share from her work. So, like I said, I'd like to know more about who she was, how she came to study this at UCLA, more about the you know, her mission while she was there in the industry.
Go ahead.
Right, I was just going to say that I think that to add on what Jenny Stover was saying, just because the tendency was to marginalize and limit the voices, some voices got through. Yeah. And that's like what's the most fun to study as a scholar, is to look at, you know, who gets through and who gets to, you know, what particular chemistry, you know, what particular alchemy is happening that they get to have their voices on the radio, even in a sort of warped kind of way.
I feel like a lot of it's persistence. You know, I feel like with her, you know, just constantly pounding the pavement and showing up and, you know, pushing. And I think that's definitely, you know, a very, very important.
Yeah.
And so, like I mentioned, I think it'd be really interesting, Jennifer Hyland Wong, we've talked to you before about the parallels between the early days of radio and with the early days of podcasting, and how women were a part of the production of podcasts from the very beginning, as they were in radio. So if maybe we could talk about that, and also with an eye to representation, like we're talking about now, were all women making podcasts in these early days, and what types of podcasts were we seeing?
Well, in the early 2000s, 2005, there were a lot of a lot of different kinds of experiments. I don't think we'll ever know exactly how much, because what we have left are the traces, right? Whatever we can find on the Internet Wayback Machine and the Internet Archive, mm-hmm. or what the people who had the means to save their podcasts on SoundCloud or some of these kind of podcast directories. But there was actually a wider diversity than you would think. In particular, I'm doing some work right now looking at early knitting podcasts, which is odd. You would think that's a very tactile medium, not predisposed. But then when you start to think about how, you know, radio's biggest comedy was a blackface routine, and one of the most popular radio shows involved a ventriloquist and his dummy, it makes a little bit, more sense. They were a wide-ranging group of women with different views of how to use the medium. And so I kind of think of it this way. The radio amateurs in the early 1920s had a really different idea how to use the medium. They wanted to speak to each other. They wanted to see how far their signals could go. They wanted to entertain each other. And they did not envision this kind of commercial future. And I think in that same way, the early women podcasters were interested in forming communities. And in particular, what I'm discovering thus far early in my research is that knitting podcasts were more often vehicles to develop these kind of communities of practice as a way to practice that sort of a hobby. I'm seeing in some of these early knitting podcasts, one podcast called Craft Lit, they read classical literature for you to knit by. Another Cast On with Brenda Dane, they focus on playing sort of great indie music that she finds from the PodSafe network. And this is as early as 2005. So one of the first among the first dozens of podcasts that were done. And so she tells stories and has this great indie music for people to knit by. So it's a way to sort of cultivate community in addition to develop this sort of practice. And so they're a really different idea than Serial, perhaps, or the more kind of commercial podcast. How can I make profit out of that?
Yeah, Jenny Stover, what are your thoughts about those early days of podcasting?
Oh my goodness, that sounds, I think it sounds fantastic. The having someone read you literature to knit by, it actually reminds me of the practice in the factories in, you know, kind of turn of the 19th century, where there would be readers employed to read while folks like rolled cigars or whatever their, you know, their factory work was. And that was actually a very important role. So yeah, this little sound aside, the author James Weldon Johnson was used to read out loud at factories as he was starting to write. In terms of early podcasting and sounding out, I was looking to see who some of our early podcasters were. And I think we started in 2010, and we have a lot of it was for documentation in a way, like Miley Colbert was a regular writer for us. She's a sound artist working out of Portugal. And, you know, she put together, you know, various interviews that she had done with sound scholars like Hildegard Westerkamp and folks about, you know, what a soundscape is, what are sound walks, and really documenting women's role in the field. And which is, it's like that kind of gap is like her filling that gap, but then her also documenting her as a sound artist doing this kind of work. So it's like this double documentation and representation for women. We also have our regular podcaster. She's been with us several years, Marcella Ernest, who is an Indigenous sound artist and scholar, and she uses her podcast series as a way to take on and discuss, you know, issues of decolonizing language and language practice. And one podcast of hers that I use regularly when I teach is on different different perceptions of silence and how silence speaks in various Indigenous communities. And she has she brings on the Indigenous women from multiple parts of North America to talk about their perspectives on silence. And that has been a really another form of documentation at the intersection of race and gender. And that's been really powerful. So we on Sounding Out have seen that kinds of work really intensely in our podcast series. And that's the kinds of work that, you know, we really appreciate and welcome.
That's the voice of Jenny Stover, who is our guest today on Radio Survivor. Jenny Stover is Associate Professor of English at Binghamton University and co-founder and editor-in-chief of the Sounding Out podcast, the Sound Studies podcast. And our guest today as well on Radio Survivor is Jennifer Hyland Wong, adjunct professor at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. My name is Eric Klein, and my co-host is Jennifer Waits.
So I wanted to talk a little bit about what's going on right now in podcasting. It's been an interesting year. We, as we're recording this, we're marking a year of the pandemic. And Jennifer Hyland Wong, I know you've written about stay-at-home podcasters, and how is that different right now when a lot of us are at home? So this idea of staying at home and podcasting, and there have been a lot of changes in the world related to sound with a lot of people on Zoom and video calls. So how does that affect our overall understanding of the soundscape? And I'd love to have both of your takes on it, but maybe start with Jennifer Hyland Wong on who stay-at-home podcasters are.
That's a great question. I think, you know, traditionally the sort of moniker stay-at-home podcast like marks almost like a personal denigration in some sense of like, this is all that I'm doing, right? You know, like this. And I think that the soundscape is changed by the fact that houses aren't as ideologically traditionally gendered in the sense that there's not a home space that that women are supposed to be in. There's not this office space that men are supposed to be there. There's a sort of diversity of people sort of living and managing in their own houses. I'm kind of thinking about makes me think about my students. I'm working right now on I'm teaching a history of broadcasting class, and I'm having my students keep a pandemic media journal. And their job is to kind of write down how they're using media like headphones and earbuds to keep out sounds from other people in the house, from roommates, from family members, writing down what media they're using, how much media they're using, what their feelings are about the media that they're using. And it just kind of makes me think about that, you know, there's a lot of negotiation that's happening kind of right now.
And I think Jenny Stover, well, the listeners don't know this, but I think Jenny Stover had to mute herself because somebody's phone was ringing, which is just like the perfect thing to happen as we're all recording this podcast at home.
Yes. I was thinking as you were talking that, you know, that stay-at-home podcasting sounds kind of like it's denigrating because of the way that stay-at-home mom has been gendered and denigrating, right? It's borrowing from that term. So I think there's a, you know, talking about the gendering of that is really key. And it's interesting because there has been gendering of the household, and it might be in terms of podcasting, like what I'm hoping, I guess, is, you know, more women having facility with technology in ways that in the 50s, 60s, 70s, and even into the 80s, that women were actively discouraged from. You know, there's a piece from Kathleen Hanna where it's called "On Not Playing Dead," where she talks about how her brother told her that his amp would shock her if she plugged the cord in and to her guitar. And so, you know, and for years she talked about like how that made her fearful of playing around with his sound equipment. So, you know, I'd done some work on the tape recorder and the gendering of the tape recorder as male after World War II. And that was the era of the hi-fi stereo. And there's arguments that because of the open floor plan in these ranch houses, that was kind of, you know, men's way of using technology to isolate themselves and claim space in the domestic space that this kind of was deemed the women's domain to take care of. So the fact that now technology might be serving as a way to, you know, challenge the gendering of space is really exciting. It makes it sound much more exciting than us all being holed up at home with our headphones. Like there's space wars going on, you know, and we're resisting in those ways, big and small. It's fantastic.
And I'm not sure how, I don't have a lot of evidence yet about how these women podcasters are podcasting now with the entire family sort of at home or being in a sort of lockdown pandemic sort of situation. But certainly the kind of production practices that they had, recording in stolen moments in front of the bedroom mirror, sitting in a closet, doing their show notes in a car, in a minivan, watching the soccer game, or working, you know, all of those spaces that are these just like little spaces for sort of creativity are harder and harder to find right now in sort of pandemic lockdown. And so I just sort of wonder how those podcasters right now who are trying to just have some space to have a voice, how they are even continuing. There's a whole paper that could be written just on the soundscape of the closet, like the notion of like broadcasting from your, you know, essentially broadcasting from your closet.
Well, and this conversation is also making me think about how all of us, those domestic spaces, we're now seeing domestic spaces of our local broadcasters on TV.
Yes.
And so everything has changed and we're all becoming more accustomed to hearing imperfect audio, even on our local news. You know, I live in a major market and the local news, we have people on, you know, the morning news show who are broadcasting from their kids' bedroom. And these are men too, you know, so we're seeing men in domestic spaces, including bedrooms and kitchens.
The pandemic began, think back a year ago to one of the first memes of the pandemic. And it was when the dad, the British dad, I believe, and his Korean wife and their child entered his room and interrupted his spot on the BBC. That was how this all began. And I just watched last week, I believe, a different dad in a different room greet, just so smoothly deal with the fact that his daughter walked into the TV shot, said hi to him. He said, hello, sweetheart, and like gave her a kiss, but didn't like miss a beat in his interview about politics. His personal stock went way up for me in how he gracefully handled his daughter's interruption on that television program he was appearing on.
Yeah. So how do you think this will change broadcasting that we're seeing these domestic spaces and hearing, you know, I guess we're probably hearing them on the radio as well. I'm more attuned to it perhaps when I see it on television, because it's so obvious that somebody is in their child's bedroom broadcasting. But on the radio, we might be hearing imperfect sound. We might be hearing cats and dogs. We might be hearing somebody crying in the background. And how is that going to change our sonic space?
I hope it would open it up. I hope it would privilege or prioritize at least imperfect audio. Because as you know, some female podcasters have said, I mean, there's a story in that sound. There's a story in the imperfect kind of domestic audio. And for that to be regularized would be fantastic. But I would say, I'm just even thinking right now, in order to even make this podcast, I have a system of barriers put in place to handle the fact that I have three kids and two dogs and a husband working from home right now. And I have a series of gates, people on different dogs, like everything to try to create this sort of more perfect, right, audio soundscape. So I don't know. I don't know if that impulse is going to quite die for the most professional audio or the clearest kind of most perfect sound, which then eliminates a lot of voices from the airwaves.
Yes, I usually go to the car, and I was thinking like, dang, I should have gone to the car. But then it becomes like, can I get the internet to broadcast from the car? The sound will be great because of all of the, Steph Sarasso writes about all of the wonder, you know, all the car technology to make it a quieter ride. So you can use that in terms of your studio. But yeah, then you might not have the internet, and then you'll be coming in and out. And so if it's not one thing, it's another. I feel like, you know, my students laugh at me sometimes when I'm teaching because I look so panicked, and I'm like, it's like I'm producing a television show or something. And they describe me as, you look like a hacker in a 90s or early 2000s movie, like from the other side of the computer. And I'm like, that's it. That's exactly how I feel. Like, I just have a few minutes. I can do it.
That's, I feel like that's just Gen Z, you know, being shady to Gen X.
You know, Jolie was a hacker. I'll take it.
Jenny Stover, when you were
It's a very powerful position to be a hacker, and I would I would just own that, Jenny Stover.
Oh, yeah.
Jenny Stover, when you were on Radio Survivor back in 2018, 3 years ago, you implanted an idea in my head that has never left, that that professional sound, the sound of a radio studio or professional recording studio is the sound of silence. And when we hear anything other than silence, that's a signal to our ears as consumers that we're not listening to professionally recorded sound. And it's quite a moment for sound during the pandemic. Whose homes are quiet enough to pull off the trick, and who lives in a space where they literally would not be invited on a television program because they cannot produce quiet. They just can't. Like, my apartment has this many people, and that's how it's gonna sound chaotic no matter what. Which is also I just have to mention, like, how do kids go to school in that soundscape? You know, there are some students who are gonna have a very noisy home.
I was just going to say that it makes me think of some advice that someone gave me before I started teaching online this semester. And they said that the best way to teach online is to act like you're a DJ, which is a very sort of Gen X, like we would understand that. Yeah. You're a DJ, just kind of riffing online. And that's like the best way to kind of get your point across.
Yeah. And I think we've talked about it before. Maybe many of us have that college radio DJ pass to draw on.
Yeah.
I was, you know, it's really interesting to think about, like, also, at least for me, when I'm teaching, I've had students be all sorts of places, you know, in the hallway, on the floor, like just trying to come to class. And I think that one of, you know, back to thinking about the tenacity of women in the 20s, 30s, 40s, trying to get on the radio and broadcast and be heard. I feel like now it's like the tenacity to listen and be included. I was on a panel with for Cornell that was actually about incarcerated poets and kind of carceral soundscapes. And there was someone on that call who was speaking from their roof in the Bronx. And so it's like, I think that is, you know, is very powerful to, you know, that it, as much as it reveals all sorts of, you know, things about the inequities in our society and who has access to internet, who has access to mm-hmm. quiet, the fact that we're all trying, I feel like I'm trying so hard to listen to everyone in my class, that, you know, that's remembering that kind of desire to pull people in and hold them close through these technologies, I think, is important.
And Jenny Stover, you talked a lot when we had you on previously about all of us being these more active listeners, like you're talking about, and maybe if you could share some of those tips, especially now when I think more people are attuned to the work that we all have to do to create a better anti-racist world. How would you suggest, what are your tips on how we should be listening to other people?
Wow. I guess, like, my, you know, one of my techniques is truly always to meet people where they're at and how they speak and how they feel comfortable speaking. One of the things that, as a, you know, we have no official language in this country, and, you know, there's, you know, that there's a very strong English dominance. And I think that, you know, there are so many people in this country that are bilingual that we all have accents, all of us do. And, you know, there's been so much racism directed in the past 4 years, 4.5 years, to people who speak accented, you know, so-called accented English. And I, you know, I always remind my students that it's, you know, we have to also have accented ears. We have to become, all of us, experts in listening to, you know, to the sound of English in multiple accents. You know, and all of us, I think, work toward being multilingual as well. But, you know, once listeners start thinking about, you know, oh, I can't understand you, et cetera, et cetera, then you stop listening to anything at all. And that's one thing I definitely, for monolingual English speakers in the U.S., that's one of the things I very much stress.
Yeah, I like that idea of putting the onus on the listener. And that's something that maybe we always think about is putting work into our listening.
Yes. Yes. We, you know, it traditionally, especially white listeners, have, you know, demanded that everyone else shape their sounds to their ears, when, you know, we need to be thinking like, oh, I need to become more competent in listening to, you know, someone with a Danish accent speaking English. Like, I can get competent at that, you know?
Right. Yeah. In the United States media environment, every audience member loves a British accent, and nobody wants to hear a Mexican accent on there. These are the extremes that I'm highlighting. That's the voice of Jenny Stover, Associate Professor of English at Binghamton University and co-founder and editor-in-chief of the Sounding Out Sound Studies blog. We're also here at Radio Survivor, joined by our guest, Jennifer Hyland Wong, adjunct professor at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. We're talking about voices on the radio, women's voices, especially during this Women's History Month. My name is Eric Klein. You're listening to Radio Survivor. My co-host is Jennifer Waits.
So who should we, we're talking about Women's History Month. We've talked about a lot of things today. And I'd love to get some ideas from both of you about who we should be listening to now. Are there women's voices on the radio and on podcast, either today or historically, who you have found inspirational, whose wisdom you've appreciated, shows and people and podcasts that we should be sharing with our listeners?
What a great question. This may sound silly, but I always think about Gracie Allen. I don't think that people really talk about her and her contributions. If you think about the fact that with George Burns, she partnered in a show that ran, I believe, on radio from 1932 to 1950, and then continued on in television, was sort of, you know, kind of pioneering both in both media. The popularity of them as a duo relied almost solely on her voice, right? On the power of her voice, and the linguistic slapstick that she could sort of engage in. So that would be my first instance.
I would suggest, in terms of, I was like trying to go through my Stitcher to see honestly like what my podcasts are that I listen to the most. And I have three to recommend. The contemporary podcasts. I love The Read. The Read has been on for a long time.
You're here.
Crystal. Yes.
Yeah, oh,
Crystal, as both Crystal and Kit Beery, and the way that they understand and think about and talk about popular culture and life and, you know, race, gender, class, queerness, like it's, you know, it's like like, you know, being in a conversation with a friend. And I love that podcast. I also really love a podcast called Locutora Radio. And they broadcast out of Los Angeles, and they call their podcast a radiophonic novela. And they did a podcast for Sounding Out that continues to be really popular. And that's one thing I like about our podcast on Sounding Out, to give us a plug, is that people will listen to a podcast that we put out 2 or 3 years ago that, you know, that those are there, you know, for a long duration. And they did a podcast for us about, it's called The Sonic Landscapes of Unwelcome Women of Color, Sonic Harassment and Public Space. And the hosts, Mala Munoz and Diosa Femme, talk about, you know, their daily lives, where they're walking down the street and, you know, getting harassed, you know, getting sexually abusive language thrown at them and noise, and how they actually use their headphones as a way to block that out. And that post is, you know, unfortunately continues to be really important and circulates. But a lot of the other episodes of their podcast are very much like The Read, where they go in and out of talking about popular culture and issues that are important to their listeners. They started their podcast out of a community space called Espacio 1839 in Boyle Heights, where they have a community podcast set up where folks can come in and record their sound, which has been, I think, really valuable in the podcast movement, that various community spaces have cropped up, kind of like the early radio, when so much of it was local. And but now, you know, the podcast can go all over. I also love Waiting to Exhale by Karen Tongson and Winter Mitchell Rohrbaugh. It's Exhale with an X for Generation X, looking back on the culture, all the culture from the past that you need to know for the present. And they have great humor and really awesome approach, and for, you know, what it's like to be a woman of color talking about Gen X issues.
Right. Oh my gosh. You said the word Gen X, and I went back to Kathleen Hanna, who you name checked earlier in today's podcast. And how often do I think about Black women Gen Xers when I conjure up my you know, the faces in the magazine that represent Gen X? They don't pop up as fast as, so that's exciting to hear their voices.
Yes, definitely check out Waiting to Exhale.
I will. Oh my gosh. And The Read. Yeah, The Read has helped me to be a better person, because I don't have enough friends like the hosts of The Read. But when I get to listen to their show, I feel well informed. I'm learning every episode, and it's funny and fun. Yes.
And they've done a lot to publicize therapy. And Crystal, I was reading, she's actually going to become a licensed therapist after working on that podcast. That's something she wants to do. And I think that's right. Been especially Aww. Important. Yeah.
Millennials really cool. are growing up, aren't they? They're so, it's wonderful to, as a Gen Xer, to condescend a little bit. It's nice to think about what's going to come from the culture of millennials as they turn into middle-aged elders and do what grown-ups do in this world. We're very lucky to have them.
Well, yes, they're certainly there now, and we've had millennial scholars on the show reminding us true. That they are, you know, older than you think, Eric. So
it's because I refuse to consider how old I am that I still continue to condescend to them as youngsters, when they've in fact earned their stripes, earned their gray beards.
Yes, we have many strong voices across all the generations who we should celebrate.
The two other podcasts that I think are worth a listen to is Unladylike, which is Kristen Conger and Caroline, and I can't remember her name right now, but they're both Unladylike, and I would recommend the podcast Zigzag, are both by female producers, female writers. They're kind of developing both of those podcasts, and the sort of like first attempt to do just sort of like a female gimlet, like to try to develop sort of like independent kind of production companies. Unladylike kind of discusses all things involved with gender and sexuality, and Zigzag features women talking about tech and future visions and of the society. And that's something that's kind of overcomes some hurdles that we've had in our culture about what kinds of subjects women should talk about and what kinds of subjects we shouldn't.
Well, Jennifer Highland Wong, adjunct professor at University of Wisconsin, Madison, thank you so much for joining us on Radio Survivor today.
Thank you.
And Jenny Stover, associate professor of English at Binghamton University and co-founder and editor-in-chief of Sounding Out, the Sound Studies blog and podcast. Thanks for joining us on Radio Survivor.
You're very welcome. Thank you for having me.
Radio Survivor is a radio show that you're listening to now on these airwaves. We're also a podcast where each week we can be heard on our website, radiosurvivor.com, or wherever you get your podcasts. You can subscribe to the program on the Stitcher app, on Spotify, on Google Podcasting app, whatever they call that thing, as well as Apple Podcasts. Our show is always available. One reason I mention it is today's episode on the podcast was actually a full 2 hours. And at the conclusion of the radio interview, our guests, Jenny Stover and Jennifer Highland Wong, both shared with us an extensive list of recommendations for things to listen to that are brand new, things to listen to that are from this decade at least, as well as projects they're excited about and projects they're proud of. You don't have to listen to the podcast to find that list. That list is available on our website, radiosurvivor.com, for today's the show notes for today's episode, which was 289. We'll have links to all that stuff. The podcast, as it concluded as well, included Jenny Stover shared with us her ongoing project to talk to Black and Latinx women in New York City and the Bronx whose record collections influenced their children's generation in the formation of hip-hop. A really exciting project about record collections and the ones that specifically belong to some women, some of whom were the mothers of the genre hip-hop that took over the world in the 80s and 90s. A really cool project, and it was really fun to hear about it. So that's available online at radiosurvivor.com or wherever you get your podcasts. Our email address, if you want to reach out to us and say hello or to give us feedback on the project or to ask us questions that we might be able to answer, is podcast@radiosurvivor.com. We are a listener and reader-supported enterprise. To find out more, you can go to radiosurvivor.com/support. We can be heard here each week on these airwaves talking about community radio, college radio, non-commercial radio, low-power FM radio, pirate radio, as well as podcasts and community podcasting projects. Thank you so much for listening. My name is Eric Klein. On behalf of Paul Rees-Mundell and Jennifer Waits, we'll see you next week.